In the previous lecture, we saw how anthropology and all the social sciences had built an evolutionary framework by the 1860s. Modern anthropology, though incorporating some of these foundations, can also be seen as partly a reaction against the idea of unilineal evolution. The reasons for the growth of modern anthropology are complex, but we can point to a few strands. One is illustrated by these Anglo-Saxon objects, namely the grave intellectual doubts. Maitland, the historian, put this very well. Even had our anthropologists at their command material that would justify them in prescribing that every independent portion of mankind must, if it is to move at all, move through one fated series of stages, which may be designated as stage A, stage B, stage C, and so forth, we still should have to face the fact that the rapidly progressive groups have been just those which have not been independent, but have appropriated alien ideas, and have thus been enabled, for anything that we can tell, to leap from stage A to stage X without passing through any intermediate stages. Our Anglo-Saxon ancestors did not arrive at the alphabet or at the Nicene Creed by traversing a long series of stages. They leapt to the one and leapt to the other. Another kind of attack was a moral one. As Jarvie, in The Revolution in Anthropology, puts it, all surviving societies must be viable, and Malinowski even goes further. They are equally viable, equally good, equal in fact. The wheel has come round full circle. Prima facie differences aren't even real now. There are no differences. Any social system good enough for men to live in is as good as any other. There are no savages, no differences, only human social diversity. The evolutionary theory had been based on an organic metaphor, that of plants, of origins, of growth, of development, and of change. The structural theories that have replaced it are based on different metaphors. One is that of the machine, in which each part has a function in relation to the rest. Indeed, the new theory was called functionalism. As the anthropologist Evans Pritchard puts it, just as earlier the genetic approach was dominant in all fields of learning, so now we find everywhere a functional orientation. There were functional biology, functional psychology, functional law, functional economics, and so forth, as well as functional anthropology. The questions behind anthropology change, from how did mankind originate, how can different societies be placed on one scale or ladder, to how does society work? How do different parts fit in or function within a social structure? What do they do? For example, instead of looking at witchcraft beliefs, as in this Goya painting, as a stage in the growth towards our own rationality, one looked to see what witchcraft did for a particular society, as a system of explanation, how it fitted with kinship, economics, and so on. Thus, there is a rejection of what was termed conjectural, guesswork history, and a more relativistic interest in the present. The changeover of perspective and the essence of functionalism are well expressed in the anthropologist Radcliffe Brown's preface to the 1932 edition of The Andaman Islands. In 1908, when the writing of this book was undertaken, anthropologists and ethnologists were concerned either with formulating hypotheses as to the origins of institutions, or with attempts to provide hypothetical reconstructions of the details of culture history. In the new approach, the meaning of a word, a gesture, a rite, lies in what it expresses, and thus is determined by its association within a system of ideas, sentiments, and mental attitudes. The notion of function in ethnology rests on the conception of culture as an adaptive mechanism by which a certain number of human beings are enabled to live a social life as an ordered community in a given environment. Every custom and belief of a primitive society plays some determinate part in the social life of the community, just as every organ of a living body plays some part in the general life of the organism. Hence, an anthropologist would be interested to find out why exactly the women in the foreground are wearing the fingers and toe bones of their ancestors as necklaces, and in the centre a widow is wearing the skull of her late husband on her shoulder. The intellectual shift of theories was partly related to deep political, economic, and social changes. One of these was the collapse of the superiority of the West, which had become assumed. The massive lead, industrial, technological, imperial, over the rest of the world, and the era of rapid expansion, began to slow down, the gap to narrow, in the 1890s. Thus, writing in 1904, the geographer Mackinder wrote, "When historians in the remote future come to look back on the group of centuries through which we are now passing, and see them foreshortened, it may well be that they will describe the last 400 years as the Columbian epoch, and will say that it ended soon after the year 1900. Broadly speaking, we may contrast the Columbian epoch with the age which preceded it by describing its essential characteristics as the expansion of Europe against almost negligible resistance, whereas medieval Christendom was pent into a narrow region and threatened by external barbarism." From the present time forth, in the post-Columbian age, we shall again have to deal with a closed political system, and nonetheless that it will be one of worldwide scope, as we can see in this picture where old Father Time spins the wheel of fortune in the game of nations at the turn of the century. The stirrings had begun early, for instance with the Indian Mutiny in 1857, but the shattering final knell was when the apparently rational nations of the earth, the enlightened lords of creation, tore each other to pieces in the bloody carnage of the First World War. It was symbolically appropriate that the same war, by making a virtual prisoner of Bronislaw Malinowski on the Trobriand Islands, should produce the new studies of an intensive kind that were to usher in modern anthropology. Technological changes were of benefit to anthropology in various ways. Previously, the evolutionist fantasies of Avebury and others were possible to sustain because the huge distances between us and them could make most people believe in the inferiority of savage races. Although we may smile, this caption depicting a sailing ship as the most powerful of all the modern weapons of anthropology has a truth in it. Modern communication allowed people to go, explore, settle, and study the various peoples of the world, and these communications improved dramatically at the end of the 19th century. The other major revolutionary change was in the development of the camera. Although invented in the 1820s, for all intents and purposes, it was not until the 1890s that it began to have an impact. All that people saw of primitive peoples up till then were in woodcuts, lithographs, a few objects, and the occasional native brought over for an exhibition. For instance, in this woodcut at the front of The Natural History of Man by J.G. Wood, we are shown the races of Africa assembled. Each one is described in a derogatory way. From the 1890s onwards, and then increasingly from the early 20th century, the camera became an essential tool for anthropology, giving the lie to many stereotypes. At first, the photographs had to be posed and slow, but this still allowed such magnificent examples as Edward Curtis's monumental documentation of the American Indians at the turn of the century. Or Charles Hose's Borneo photographs. Between the world wars, new cameras with faster lenses revolutionized photojournalism and photoanthropology. Moments in time could be caught, first in black and white, as in these photographs of Sarawak, and later, as with this African Kung woman and her child, and other Bushmen. The revolution was completed when moving film allowed one to see different societies as they actually seem to exist. And even to hear them. Technology which allowed one to go there and to record in a far more accurate way when one did get there were only a part of a methodological revolution. The period of field work or participant observation. Although the myth tells us that it was Bronislaw Malinowski who invented field work in the Trobriand Islands during the First World War, of course there had been for centuries people who lived for long years in other cultures, learning their languages and studying them. Missionaries such as Lafitau, traders, painters such as George Catlin, who painted the North American Indians. But anthropology proper dates from the investigations in the 1870s and 80s by men like Lewis Henry Morgan among the Iroquois, and Boaz in his trip to Baffin Island in the 1880s. Manuals such as Notes and Queries on Anthropology charted this change. The first edition was produced in 1874, but it is not until the fourth edition, prepared in 1907, that one sees the new intensive anthropological fieldwork methodology reflected. For instance, W. H. Rivers of Cambridge wrote in his piece on sociological method and note-taking, "One great difficulty of the work with which this book is concerned is that the inquirer and his witnesses speak different languages, and the difficulty at once divides anthropological work into two classes. One in which the inquirer has learnt the language of the people with whom he is working, or, as in this case with Margaret Mead, she is working. The other, in which reliance is placed upon the services of interpreters. It is not necessary to insist on the immense natural superiority of the first class of work. It is difficult in a lecture hall in high-tech Cambridge to give the flavour of the pioneer days of anthropological fieldwork. The best I can do is to show you some excerpts from a series of films called Strangers Abroad, shown on Channel 4 a couple of years ago. The full films are available in the Department of Social Anthropology.
In 1883, a young German scientist called Franz Boas arrived here in the Canadian Arctic. He came here to do two things. He'd originally done part of his training in geography, and he was going to map as much of the coastline, which was pretty much uncharted in those days, as possible. He was also going to indulge his new interest, the study of culture. The year before he came up here, he'd been reading up as much as possible about the Arctic. But unlike most explorers, he'd also bothered to take some courses in the local language, Inuktitut. He was born in 1858 in Minden, Westphalia. His father was a prosperous businessman in the town, and at the age of 20, Boas left home to study geography at the University of Heidelberg. It was during his year of compulsory military training in 1881 that he decided to study the relation of the Eskimo to their environment. In his own words, he was going to collect anthropological material and make a thorough study of the language, customs, and habits of the Eskimo. But he also kept a diary of letters to present to his fiancée on his return. These provide a fascinating insight into the ambitions, frustrations, hardships and loneliness of Arctic exploration before the turn of the century.
Only 2 days more, and the year begins which will take me to you. The time passes almost too quickly for the amount of work I have to do here. If I accomplish everything, I still will not have the time to finish the map and the ethnographic work. I shall, however, attain my own purposes very well. I know very accurately about the migration of the Eskimo and the routes they take, how they travel back and forth, and their relationship to neighboring tribes. The Eskimo exhibit a thorough knowledge of the geography of their country. The area they travel over is of considerable extent. They have a very clear conception of all the countries they have seen or heard of, knowing the distances by days' journeys, or as they say, by sleeps, and the directions by the cardinal points.
Boas got the Eskimo of Cumberland Sound to draw these maps on paper. These he collected and brought back. They compared remarkably well with his own. As a geographer, he'd been taught to believe that the life of people like the Eskimo was entirely determined by their environment. He was finding out the hard way that this couldn't be the case.
Today I went hunting, but not with exactly splendid success. The only thing I shot was pulled under the ice by the current. There I sat, like an Eskimo, behind my ice hole at the water's edge, and patiently waiting for a head to appear. I cannot imagine what an impression it makes in this cold season to sit so near the edge of the water and to hear the roaring and foaming. Thick fog from the cold water envelops me. At my feet, the water foams and hisses. Only a strong current keeps the water from freezing here. Last night, I dreamt very vividly that I was in America and with you. The dream was so vivid that I was most disappointed when I woke up in the morning to find myself in the igloo. You must not imagine that such a snow hut is a cold home. It is completely papered with skins, and two lamps are kept burning. They supply light and heat. We all sit on a large platform which is covered with caribou skins. But I think I still prefer a European home. Today I hunted just as an Eskimo, with a spear and all that goes with it. Oxytum was the only one who caught anything. Two seals, which I immediately acquired. As you see, Marie, I am now a true Eskimo. I live as they do, hunt with them, and belong to the men of Ananindum.
Important and interesting personalities in the development of scientific thought spent his working life as a don here at St. John's College in Cambridge. And although he was a shy and retiring personality, Dr. William Rivers moved with great ease between several branches of science. He started off as a doctor, did research into the nervous system and into the action of drugs on the human body, became a leading psychologist, and went on to make a major contribution to psychiatry.
But it was almost by chance that Rivers developed an interest in the newer discipline of anthropology. In academic circles, curiosity had been kindled by the work of one Cambridge scholar, Sir James Fraser. His widely read book on anthropology, The Golden Bough, had caused tremendous interest in Cambridge during the 1890s.
One particular topic that was being discussed in and out of Rivers' rooms was an exciting and imaginative project. An expedition to investigate the cultures on a remote group of islands in the Torres Straits between Australia and New Guinea. The expedition was to be made up of Cambridge men, and Rivers was to be the psychologist. His brief was to investigate the mental characteristics of the islanders. It was Rivers' systematic approach to this psychological testing that was to bring a scientific method into anthropology.
The man behind this new approach to studying native peoples was, strangely enough, a zoologist called Alfred Court Haddon.
Travelling scholars are often enough sent out by both Oxford and Cambridge, but this is probably the first time that a real exploring expedition has been sent out by either university. The expedition is bound first for Torres Strait between Australia and New Guinea.
The straits were dotted with small tropical islands, each with its own distinct cultural features. In the recent past, the islanders had had a notorious reputation for cannibalism. A contemporary newspaper reported the aims of the expedition. Their beliefs and superstitions will be studied, it said, and in short, every variety of observation made in order to obtain a complete conception of the condition of a people at the stage of those in the Torres Straits. Each member of the expedition will have a particular department to attend to. Two of them will study native psychology, in the field as it were. Dr. Myers will attend to native music, while decorative art will be the speciality of Dr. Haddon. Mr. Ray will study the languages, while the wonderful folklore of the Torres Straits people will be recorded by Dr. Haddon himself, who already has a wonderful store of interesting stories. Some aspects of that culture still survive today, as do some of the stories. It's one of the ways that tradition on these islands has been preserved.
There was an island called Meh, And on this island live Sim and May. They live at a village called Las. They are the four children who were all boys.
The dance recreates the traditional method of sardine fishing, a technique now remembered only by a much older generation. But it was a feature that was well documented by the expedition. It was the expedition's first base is now a ruin. It must have been a strange scene to witness those six Victorian scholars using interpreters, pursuing their own particular scientific interest, right in the middle of daily native life. It was a breathtakingly ambitious project to attempt in the relatively short period of time that they spent here on these islands. Languages, customs, activities, technical skills, music, mythologies, disease profiles, even the games that the natives played were recorded and described. They also made what is a now famous collection of objects from native life, both the fantastic and the mundane. These were eventually to fill 40 crates which were shipped back to England. But apart from the usual notebooks, artifacts and photographs, those crates contained two kinds of data that hadn't usually been brought back from the field. These were the sound recordings that they made using wax cylinders and the first anthropological cine film footage ever to be shot.
Like so much of the early material shot by the pioneers of cine film, most of the Torres Straits footage has been lost, damaged beyond repair before the need for conserving film stock was realized. Of all the fascinating ceremonies and activities that they witnessed, only a tantalizing fragment of film remains. Fortunately, more of the sound that they recorded has survived.
By the aid of a phonograph, records of many songs were secured, and these have been subjected to detailed examination. Some of the songs are religious and ancient, others relatively modern. Some are sung at games, others at dances.
The natives of the Torres Straits were recorded in their own language, speaking phrases, reciting mythologies, and singing their songs. But Rivers' task was examining the mental characteristics of the islanders, and this he did by examining their senses. And he started with the one he knew most about, vision. He'd taken along with him the latest apparatus for examining visual acuity and spatial and colour perception. After several weeks, he thought that he was observing a pattern of differences emerging in the way that the Murray Islanders perceived and named different colours.
What accounted for these differences? Well, one of the possibilities that occurred to Rivers was that the variations in native colour perception, that is the way that they saw, described and named different colours, might run in families. To evaluate this, he had to find out exactly how people were related to each other, and so he went about collecting family trees or genealogies. Several things impressed him. First of all, the people of this island had an extensive...
Imagine yourself suddenly set down, surrounded by all your gear, alone on a tropical beach close to a native village, or the launch which has brought you sails away out of sight. Imagine further that you are a beginner, without previous experience, with nothing to guide you, and no one to help you, for the white man is absent. This exactly describes my first initiation into field work.
He wasn't taking part in their daily lives, and he realized that to do this, he had to come down off the veranda and actually go and live with the natives themselves.
My anthropological explorations absorb me a great deal, but they suffer from two basic defects. One, I have rather little to do with the savages on the spot. Do not observe them enough. And two, I do not speak their language. This second epoch will be hard enough to overcome. Establish myself in Omarakana. I began to take part, in a way, in the village life, to look forward to the important or festive events, to take personal interest in the developments of the small village occurrences, to wake up every morning to a day presenting itself to me more or less as it does to the native. I would get out from under my mosquito net to find around me the village life beginning to stir, for the people well advanced in their working day, according to the house and also to the season. For they get up and begin their labours, early or late, as work presses. As I went on my morning walk through the village, I could see intimate details of family life, of toilet, cooking, taking of meals. I could see the arrangements for the day's work, people starting on their errands, or groups of men and women busy at some manufacturing tasks. Quarrels, jokes, family scenes, events usually trivial, sometimes dramatic, but always significant, form the atmosphere of my daily life as well as of theirs.
When I was a small child, my mother was studying Italian immigrants in the United States. So I grew up with a general interest in other kinds of people and the way they live, and realizing that the way they live was systematic, and that it was important for us to understand more about other people in the world. When I was a senior in college, I worked under Professor Franz Boas at Columbia and under Ruth Benedict, and for the first time realized that primitive societies were priceless records of a disappearance.
To go into the field as an anthropologist. In later life, she remembered what a daunting task this was for a young woman of 23.
I think my first field trip was, in a sense, the most difficult, because I did a kind of work nobody'd done then, so there weren't many models at all. I was just told not to waste my time doing conventional things, and that I was to learn the language and get acquainted with the adolescent girls and find out what they were up to. I'd never eaten any food except American food, and I had to learn to eat Samoan food. And also, there weren't any styles of work then. In Samoa, I learned to dance and learned to talk a very elegant language. And in return for the help they gave me, I conformed to many of the styles of their society.
I have often been asked whether, when I was among the Azande, I got to accept their ideas about witchcraft. I suppose you can say I accepted them. I had no choice. In my own culture, I rejected Zande notions of witchcraft. In their culture, I accepted them. In a kind of way, I believed them.
Edward Evans Pritchard, one of the most famous of British anthropologists. In many ways, his background was one of privilege, certainly as far as his education was concerned. Evans Pritchard's experience of life among cultures very different from his own was to produce a finer understanding of apparently irrational behaviour and ideas. A surviving recording of his voice, made late in his life, Evans Pritchard recalled some aspects of his experiences as an anthropologist among the Nuer.
Government were more or less war with the Nuer at the time, and I was dumped down there among them, and there was no grammar, no dictionary, no interpreter, and one just had to do the best one could to make friends with them. And how do you go about doing that, you may ask? I was all by myself. I had no police, I had no soldiers or anything. The Nuer saw that, being intelligent, charitable people, that I was all alone and helpless, and they just accepted me as a guest. Took me some months to learn the language adequately. I learned usually through the children. I used to go out fishing with their little sons and so on. The children accept you. Sooner or later their parents will accept you too. And the Noah slowly came along bit by bit to my tent and used to come and talk to me, and I think they regarded me as rather an oddity, really. I mean, I was living in the very center of their cattle camps, or their villages. They got used to me. I lived right in the middle of them, you see. Nothing which went on could have been missed by me, because I was one of them, really.
It's clear from his elegant description of their attitudes to life that Evans Pritchard identified closely with the Nuer.
The Nuer is a product of a hard and egalitarian upbringing. He is deeply democratic and is easily roused to violence. His turbulent spirit finds any restraint irksome, and no man recognizes a superior. That every Nuer considers himself as good as his neighbor is evident in their every movement. They strut about like lords of the earth, which indeed they consider themselves to be. There is no master and no servant in their society, but only equals who regard themselves as God's noblest creation. Their respect for one another contrasts with their contempt for all other peoples. Material is as simple as that of the Nuer, are highly dependent on their environment. At heart, they are herdsmen, and the only labor in which they delight is the care of cattle. They not only depend on cattle for many of life's necessities, but they have the herdsman's outlook on the world. Cattle are their dearest possession, and they gladly risk their lives to defend their herds or to pillage those of their neighbors.
Apology, you are studying not just as an observer, but also as a participant. You are not just a member of the audience, you are also on the stage. To understand the Nuer, you've got to learn to think as a Nuer, to feel as a Nuer, in a kind of way to be a Nuer. And this can't be done by any kind of scientific technique. And this is why the anthropologist, I think, is in a very peculiar position, because he's trying to interpret what he sees, not just with the head, but with his whole personality, with his heart as well.
Of course, since those pioneering days, there have been many further developments. We saw the fruits of some of them in the first two lectures, and you will hear about others during the anthropology course. Among these are the rise of a renewed interest in Marxist anthropology, in transactionalism, and in structuralism. Structuralism is associated with the work of Lévi-Strauss. Part of it is concerned with the way in which human beings think. For instance, how they classify, how they distinguish between nature and culture. The external world is continuous, but we have to draw boundaries, to make divisions between parts of it in order to understand it. Functionalism, we have seen, is concerned with the meaning of parts in relation to the whole. Witchcraft within a society, gestures within a ritual. In structuralism, meaning lies not in the thing itself, or even in a thing's function in relation to its context, but in the relations between things. Hence, not A or B, but A in relation to B, in other words, C. This explains the great interest in marriage, for instance, as an exchange or alliance between groups, or in the study of tribal art. One of the tasks is to relate these relations to each other, and hence seek out the deeper structures which, like Chomskyan linguistic deep structures, generate the surface phenomenon of life. As left is to right, so black is to white, so female is to male, so night is to day, so nature is to culture.